from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, Attorney General Eric Holder said that the time has come for shorter prison sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. He is not alone these days in calling to drive down the American prison population, number one in the world. Big Republicans from Rand Paul to Mike Lee to John Cornyn are on board. The New View says stuffed prisons are unsustainable, morally off course, and ineffective in preventing crime. But fear of crime still haunts the debate. This hour On Point, the new push for sentencing reform and a smaller prison population in the USA. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What is the best way to balance public safety, fiscal responsibility, and compassionate justice? Have we gone too far, way too far, with imprisonment? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The message coming from quarters where it would not have been expected only a few years ago. Here's Republican Senator from Kentucky, Rand Paul, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in favor of repealing minimum sentencing laws.
If I told you that one out of three African-American males is forbidden by law from voting, you might think I was talking about Jim Crow 50 years ago. Yet today, a third of African-American males are still prevented from voting because of the war on drugs.
And here's Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah saying it may have worked in some dimensions, but it's just too much. He's co-sponsor of a Senate bill that would change drug sentencing policy. Said that government must balance punishing crime and rehabilitating criminals. He was talking here at a conference on criminal justice reform.
Prevailing law enforcement strategies have helped make communities safer all around the country. And yet the current system, for all its merits, nonetheless leaves too many Americans behind. We have the challenge of overcriminalization, of over-incarceration, and over-sentencing. We have a mountain of empirical evidence demonstrating the social and economic value of stable, intact families.
And, of course, it's not just Republicans. In January, in his State of the State speech, New York Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo addressed his efforts to lower the incarceration rates in New York.
We have good news in the criminal justice front. The good news is crime is down and our prisons have fewer people in them. We are reducing the madness of an incarceration society and ending a system of unnecessary human and financial waste. And now we have eliminated 5,500 prison beds.
Well, let's take the measure of what's going on here. With us now from Charleston, South Carolina, is Brian Mann. He created the Prison Time Media Project with NPR, investigative series looking at the national impact of decades of tough drug laws. He's also the Adirondack Bureau Chief for North Country Public Radio. He's had a close eye on prison and sentencing reform for several years now. Brian Mann, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So the Attorney General made a splash last week, but he's not alone in this. Describe to us what's proposed and what series of steps has to take place to begin to rein this in. Is he calling for legislation? Are these senators responding with what Holder wants?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Eric Holder's working on a number of fronts here. He's working with federal prosecutors around the country, urging them individually to aim for lower sentences for some of these nonviolent drug offenders. So he's sort of doing with executive power what he can. But he is also testifying in support of some of these big legal changes that Congress and the Senate in particular is proposing. These are things that would shift tectonically the debate over crime and punishment in America. You would see much lower mandatory minimum sentences for these nonviolent drug crimes. You would also see more money spent on education behind bars, on drug rehab programs behind bars. An effort to kind of eliminate this recycling process where inmates spend years behind bars costing hundreds of thousands of dollars per inmate. They get back out on the streets with no job skills, and then they commit new crimes and are right back in the system. And so Eric Holder definitely has laid down a marker that he thinks that has to change. And he's got, you know, Eric Holder is not a guy who's been particularly popular on Capitol Hill and in the Senate. And yet here he is with Republican senators appearing at this point to have his back.
What does he mean by lower sentences? What do you mean by much lower sentences? I mean, I heard what he was outlining last week. You can remind us, but it seemed like marginal, like not drastic cuts. They were cuts in nonviolent drug offenders, but they weren't enormous, or are they?
Yeah, in some cases, some of the legislation would cut some of the prison times by as much as half. There are also programs proposed under some of this legislation that would allow inmates to once again, and this is a program that used to be in place, but it was eliminated during the tough on crime era, that would allow them once again to earn behind bars a 15% reduction in their sentence. So individually, these various measures aren't a huge shift, but taken together, it would begin for the first time in 30, 40 years to bend downward the curve of, you know, the high federal inmate population, which has just been soaring year by year. Some states have been implementing these ideas, Texas, New York, other states, and we have seen dramatic reductions in the number of state inmates behind bars. And I think what Holder is interested in doing is testing that at the federal level and seeing if it would begin to reduce this incredibly expensive burden of these federal institutions. You know, we're looking at a federal system that is well above the maximum number of inmates that it was designed for, 216,000 inmates now behind bars, half of them for these drug crimes that we're talking about. That's a 500% increase over 30 years, the number of people behind bars. And so these would be really baby steps, but meaningful steps toward bending that that percentage back in a different direction.
Is it only federal inmates that we're talking about in this legislation in Washington? I mean, you're talking about 200 and some thousand there, where we have heard over the years numbers getting closer to 2 million in terms of total incarcerated population in the United States.
Yeah, and this is really important for people to understand that the drug war in America has a federal component, but it also has, you know, 50 state components. And all over the U.S., you see different states experimenting with different kinds of reforms. Right now in California, for example, there's a state senator, Holly Mitchell, who's introduced new sentencing guideline reforms that would perhaps affect California's soaring inmate population. New York has already done this. Texas has done this. Colorado is looking at this. So, you know, the drug war was built over 40 years on a state-by-state and a federal basis. And now, as we're seeing a reexamination of it, we're seeing a similar kind of patchwork level of experimentation. And it's one of the fascinating things is seeing which states are taking the lead. Some of the most conservative states in the country pushing very hard to reduce their inmate populations, to lower some of these mandatory minimums. And some of those states that we all think of as being sort of lefty liberal blue states are still very much kind of in the middle of drug war era thinking, and their inmate populations are still growing.
Help us look at a couple of the big bills on Capitol Hill. We have the Smarter Sentencing Act. This was introduced by Richard Durbin, Illinois Democrat, Mike Lee, who we just heard, the Utah Republican. It would cut mandatory minimum sentences in half for certain violent drug crimes. I mean, currently those mandatory minimums are 5, 10, and 20 years. What else would it do, Brian?
Yeah, this would be an interesting set of laws. There's also, you know, this effort to reduce recidivism that a senator from Rhode Island has pushed forward. And it looks like right now there's thinking about combining and merging these two big reform bills. And Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, is talking about bringing these to the floor. Taken together, you know, what you would see is a lot of new effort in bringing the mandatory minimums down from these, you know, really quite large levels, 20 years in some cases for fairly small amounts of drugs. You're also seeing an effort to shift the measuring stick for how much drugs are needed to trigger some of these higher levels of incarceration. Another thing that's important here is that this legislation contemplates making some of these things retroactive. And so you have this huge glut of inmates who are behind bars now. This would allow more of those inmates to go back to parole boards, to the process and say, look, the laws have changed. I was sentenced to 20, 30 years behind bars for a small amount of crack cocaine, but now review my case and see if I still need to be here. And so one of the things that we could see if these laws are enacted is you could see kind of a bubble bursting here, and you could see a big chunk of inmates who apply for this early release under these new laws retroactively are granted that and are back out on the street.
Senators Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat of Rhode Island, and Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas with this other Recidivism Reduction and Public Safety Act. Those might be merged. Of course, Texas, as you say, one of the states that's been at the forefront here, more people in prison there than any other state. But they've adopted at the state level alternatives to prison. They've closed three state prisons, even as crime rates go down. And I see John Cornyn, Senator Cornyn, quoted here as saying, from Texas's perspective, the evidence is in. In other words, you can do this and not have the crime rate shoot up. But is everybody convinced of that, Brian?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's really interesting is that there was this 30-year consensus about tough on crime. Democrats, liberals, white politicians, black politicians, there was this huge push for these tough, mandatory, minimum three strikes type laws. And what's really interesting now is that there is this reverse consensus. You know, within the Republican Party, there are Tea Party senators on board with this change, with this reform movement. There are mainstream Republicans on board. And then on the Democratic side of the aisle, you've got some lawmakers who were pushing tough drug laws in the past who are now on board with reform. And so there is this shocking groundswell of support. There are people who are still very firmly opposed to this. Some federal prosecutors are saying that mandatory minimums help them attack drug criminals. One of the things that these mandatory minimums do is they convince a lot of offenders to cop pleas. They enter plea bargaining processes that means, you know, these cases don't go to trial. Prosecutors love that, and they'll be loath to give up that sort of lever they have in the judicial process. So a lot of prosecutors still asking tough questions about this reform movement.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about the new push to bring down America's world-leading prison population with sentencing reform. Brian Mann has been with us. He's with North Country Public Radio and the Prison Time Media Project, created it with NPR. He's paid a lot of attention to this. The push is on across the country at the state level, now the federal level as well. Prisons just so crowded, so many Americans in there, communities devastated. Of course, everybody wanted to push crime down, but the cost is pushed up very high now as well. Here was Eric Holder, Attorney General, testifying last week before the U.S. Sentencing Commission, endorsing a proposal that would result in shorter prison sentences for nonviolent drug offenders, saying the change would be fiscally and morally beneficial.
Now, this straightforward adjustment to sentencing ranges, while measured in scope, would nonetheless, I believe, send a strong message about the fairness of our criminal justice system. And it would help to rein in federal prison spending while focusing limited resources on the most serious threats to public safety.
Not everybody's happy about the way it's been going. California, among other states, could barely afford its own prison population last summer. The Democratic governor there announced a plan to comply with a federal court order to limit that state's prison population. Rather than releasing prisoners, Governor Brown's plan would require California to develop additional private solutions using part of the state's budget. Here's Brown.
We're now under a court order to release thousands of people to meet an arbitrary capacity figure that we don't agree with.
He doesn't like it, but there is sentiment all across the country about just how heavy some of these sentences have been for not that serious offenses. Documentary film called The House I Live In goes at this. Here's a little bit from that. 28-year-old Maurice Haltwanger was sentenced for possession of 50 grams of crack cocaine. The judge in the case, Mark Bennett, this was in Iowa, wanted to give him a shorter sentence, could not because of mandatory minimums. Here's Maurice explaining his situation as he heads off to a long time in prison.
The minimum on a conspiracy is 10 years. And then with me having a prior drug felony, the minimum is 20 years. So I got 20-year sentence today.
And here one more from The House I Live In. It won the grand jury prize for documentaries at Sundance. Here's an Oklahoma prison security chief, Michael Carpenter, talking with the filmmaker Eugene Jarecki about what he sees working in the prisons.
I think sometimes we have people doing a whole lot of time for not very much crime. It's almost like they're paying for our fear instead of paying for their crime.
Now it's become more than we can afford fiscally and maybe morally as well. Brian Mann, stand by there in Charleston. I want to bring in from St. Paul, Minnesota, Mark Osler, a former federal prosecutor, professor of law at the University of St. Thomas. He was lead counsel for the defendant in the 2009 Supreme Court case Spears versus United States, which found that sentencing judges could, quote, categorically reject, unquote, harsh sentencing guidelines for crack cocaine. Mark Osler, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's great to be here. It's an important subject.
And from Norfolk, Virginia, is Kemba Smith is joining us. In 1994, Kemba was sentenced to 24 and a half years for conspiracy to distribute crack cocaine. Her boyfriend was a dealer. She had no criminal record, was 7 months pregnant. In 2000, after serving 6.5 years in prison, she was granted clemency by President Bill Clinton. Since then, she's worked against mandatory minimum sentencing. Her autobiography, Poster Child, came out in 2012. Kemba Smith, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me and for discussing this very important issue. If it weren't people like you discussing about my issue, I would still be in prison today until the year 2016. So thank you.
Well, you may be right about that, Kemba, but the numbers have begun to turn all kinds of heads here. Just the cost of keeping people inside, the cost outside when they come out after long terms. You were in, and not for a short time, not 24 and a half years, but 6.5 is... What did you see inside and outside that's made you a campaigner against these long mandatory minimums, Kemba?
Well, I saw a lot of women who were just like me, and I'm grateful at the fact that I did receive executive clemency. I'm grateful that there's so much going on around this particular issue and this particular climate. But I have a sense of survivor's guilt in the sense that I've been out of prison over 13 years, and there are women who I know I've gone in to go speak to in the prison in Danbury where I was, and there were a couple of women who are still there who are first-time nonviolent drug offenders who have served 20 years of their sentence and still looking at a life sentence. So it's something that I'm very passionate about, and I do feel as if, you know, there are poor choices that are made. That's one of the things that I do as far as public speaking to youth across the country about making healthy choices. But there are so many first-time nonviolent offenders that could be doing the same thing. And no one's trying to discredit the choices, but just the kind of time that's being given for those choices. And my crime wasn't the fact that I was criminally minded. My crime was the fact that I fell in love with the wrong person and got involved in this drug conspiracy case. I don't know how much further you want me to get
well,
into it at this
what did
point.
You do in brief that got you 24 plus years in your sentence?
I had a drug conspiracy charge. So basically where it was talked about the prosecutors and their power in particular federal drug cases, I was held accountable for 255 keys of crack cocaine, even though the prosecutor said I never handled, sold, or used any of the drugs that were involved. Because I was in this relationship with him, and there were some things that I did do.
What were you doing? Were you banking for him or what?
Carrying money. There was a particular point where Peter had strapped money across my waist, and I can remember walking through the airport. But one of the things that's important, too, with my case is that I was also in a very abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. There was someone who was acquitted in my conspiracy drug case that was fearful of his life. And basically, that was the situation, except I was in the relationship with this particular individual.
After 6.5 years, Bill Clinton stepped in, and you're out, and now campaigning for others. We want to learn more about that. Mark Osler, I know you pay a lot of attention to this subject. You argued the very important case there before the Supreme Court. Do you see the legislation that's now coming up on Capitol Hill as of a scale and reach to be what you would consider an effective, reset of the war on drugs incarceration binge, some have called it, that we went on in this country? Will this turn it around, Mark?
Not in and of itself. I don't think it will. But it is really significant that this is happening at all. As Brian already talked about, we've got a bipartisan coalition that is doing something that we haven't seen in a long time, maybe ever. The ratchet on sentencing, particularly drug sentencing, has only gone one way. It goes up and up and up. And now we're seeing the start of something going the other way, it going back down. Cutting the mandatory minimums in half is certainly significant. The reason I say it's not enough is it doesn't solve some of the underlying problems with the way we've structured narcotic sentencing. For example, we use the weight of narcotics as a proxy for culpability. The fact that Kemba was involved in a conspiracy that had a certain amount of weight of narcotics meant that she was seen as a kingpin and sentenced that way.
I mean, 255 kilos is quite a lot, isn't it? I don't know.
It is. And that means that despite her minor role, that is going to be the principal determinant in her sentence. If we want a proxy for culpability, there's better things we could choose. For example, how much money someone actually makes. Or we could just measure culpability directly and not worry about weight so much at all.
I know you've spent a lot of time talking with the judges who have felt their hands were tied. They were doing injustice from the bench. And I want to look at that. There are so many issues that intersect here. This has become a very big business that all that government money has supported as well. Let me begin to bring our callers in. Alex in Fort Davis, Texas. Alex, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Calling from the reddest state in the country. About half the counties out here have privately operated prisons. If you start releasing low-level offenders, their occupancy rate will drop below 90%, and there goes the profits for the prison operators. This will cost these counties jobs, minimum wage, security guards. How is Eric Holder, how is anybody going to address the issue of a state whose economy is dependent on keeping as many people in private prisons for their cheap labor as is possible?
Thank Alex, we'll explore that. Do you think John Cornyn, Senator Cornyn, is wrong to support cutback change here, reform?
If he actually is talking reform, he's just going to rearrange the shuffle things around. Nothing will change in this state.
Do you think
federal help?
Do you think it's right, on the other hand, to keep people in prison as a jobs program for prison guards?
No, I think it's wrong. But the big opposite, one of the biggest opponents to the push in other states to legalize, say, marijuana.
Yeah.
Are prison operators. They make money.
Yeah, Alex, let us pick it straight up. I mean, you put your finger right on it. Brian Mann, this has become a big business around this country. And the prison operators, the private prison operators, are not quiet about reform moves. Alex is not persuaded that in the end, you know, it's going to be more than rearranging the deck chairs. What do you see coming on the economic front, Brian?
Well, this is a big part of this debate. I mean, in New York State, by July, if Governor Andrew Cuomo has his way, the state will have closed 13 prisons over the last few years, most of those in very small rural towns that had come to rely on prisons. You're seeing similar cutbacks all over the United States. Prisons, and again, this is a huge shift in the momentum of this conversation where you see prisons starting to close. And it's not just these private prison corporations. It's also public employee unions that represent a lot of the guards and corrections officers behind bars. It's local, state, and federal lawmakers who represent these districts that rely on the incarceration industry for a lot of their industrial base. And so, you know, really, I kind of describe an analogy here between the military industrial complex, which has huge political support across the country because it provides a lot of jobs across the country. The prison industry has done very much the same thing. It's rooted deeply in the fabric of the rural American economy. And so as it begins to be dismantled, at least in some pieces and in some places, there is a very ferocious debate over what happens next for those small rural towns.
Of course, this has been an issue in your neck of the woods, North Country Public Radio, upstate New York. I've got a listener here writing to us. It says, I grew up in Brian Mann's home turf. And as horrible as the prison situation is there, they compensated the employees well. Our listener writes, now with private prisons, they're taking away the tiny bit of good that came out of prisons as private prison employees get paid poorly. And goes on to say, I'd like to point out that as a former prison employee myself, the smarter employees in prison, employees there, knew that something was wrong with New York's peak prison market. A guy would murder another guy, plead to manslaughter, be out in 7 to 10 years with good behavior. Another guy would get caught with drugs one time and get guaranteed 15 to life. You were better off murdering somebody in New York than selling them drugs. Does that ring true to you, Brian? What about now?
Yeah, that injustice does register with people, even corrections officers and supervisors who are behind bars. But I have to say there's also a lot of emotion on the other side. Over the last year, I've spent a lot of time in a tiny little town called Chateauguay, New York, where mm-hmm. a prison is slated to close in July. It's 110 jobs that are going to vanish if this happens. And people there are scared. They're terrified about where their little town is going to go next. Prisons used to be viewed as recession-proof. It's been viewed as an honorable trade for people in rural America for a lot of decades. They felt like they were contributing to the safety and the street safetiness of America's cities. And so this is a very proud group of workers who are angry about where this is going. And they are not going to go down without a struggle. There's a big pushback. There was in Albany just last week, a huge rally of prison guard workers outside the state capitol demanding that Andrew Cuomo roll back some of these prison closures. People are seeing some of the injustice, but they're also looking at the future of these little towns, really iconic places, and saying, we thought this was a guaranteed way of life. What's happening to us now?
Mark Osler in St. Paul there, Minnesota, the moral calculus here gets very stretched and strange and complex when you bring in livelihoods and an industry up against years and years and years in prison. Are we settling the moral calculus? Are we working this through on moral terms, or is this going to be all about whether there's money in the government bank to pay for all this versus what's being made by private incarceration companies, Mark?
Yeah, it's both, and certainly there is that relatively small concern, I think, compared to the freedom of individuals. That's what we're talking about: is taking people like Kemba and locking them up for a lot of their life. Part of what has happened historically is that we've treated this as a moral crusade. I mean, the war on drugs was very much about morality and not about problem solving, that locking people up didn't solve the problem. Drugs are just as cheap now as they were 30 years ago. And that, so really, the morality turning the other way is something that's very significant. Just going back to the first caller, Tom, mm-hmm. about Texas, I think that there are things changing even in Texas.
You spent a lot of time in Texas.
I did. I lived there in Waco for 10 years and mm-hmm. taught at Baylor Law School. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, I got to know Waco quite well. And two remarkable things happened in the state courthouse in Waco this week. On Monday, a Baptist minister from a church there is spending Lent wearing an orange jumpsuit. His name is Kent McKeever, and he had jury duty. And he went into jury duty dressed as a prisoner, as a protest of mass incarceration. And it was treated very respectfully. There was even a story on the front page of the Waco Herald Tribune about it.
And this is no doubt a conservative Baptist church in Texas, I presume.
Moderate. But okay. There was also something happened, I think this was yesterday, maybe 2 days ago, that was just remarkable, and that is that there is a capital murder case going on. Ken Starr was called to jury duty, the president of Baylor. Mm-hmm. The Clinton special prosecutor, yeah. Former solicitor general of the United States and judge, and he was struck for cause by the prosecution in the capital murder case because of his reservations about the death penalty. Clearly something is changing when we have Baptist ministers protesting in an orange jumpsuit, when we have someone as respected by conservatives as Ken Starr speaking so publicly about problems, not just with the death penalty, but he's talking about the problem of making a case on a single witness. The mood is changing in this country, and a lot of it does have to do with morality, because when we talk about the balance between money and employment and personal freedom, locking people up, that is a moral issue.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about the new push to bring down America's world-leading prison population with sentencing reform, from Attorney General Eric Holder right up to Capitol Hill, where there's bipartisan effort underway right now with big Republican names on board to change some of the very severe mandatory sentencing laws that have stuffed America's prisons. Mike Lee of Utah, John Cornyn of Texas, Rand Paul has been a big outspoken critic of some of the impacts of this and the cost of it, which at this point financially and many say morally, has gotten very, very high. Here's Eric Holder saying we can do better. He's attacking mandatory minimum sentencing specifically in his appearance before the U.S. Sentencing Commission last week.
This initiative is a modification of the Justice Department's charging policies to ensure that people convicted of certain low-level, nonviolent federal drug crimes will face sentences appropriate to their individual conduct, rather than stringent mandatory minimums, which will now be applied only to the most serious criminals.
Kemba Smith, you were in. You did time. It could have been a lot more. Bill Clinton helped shorten it for you. But I wonder, as you listen to this debate over bringing this down, you see the financial, the fiscal pressures that are at work here in part. Do you believe, Kemba, that this country is going to, in a significant way, rebalance its incarceration policy? Do you think it'll be around the edges, or do you think it'll be a significant rebalancing as we move into this, Kemba?
Well, since over the 13 years that I've been home, I've been involved in it hasn't been significant enough. And all I can say is deep in my heart, I pray that now with Eric Holder bringing these type comments, I was fortunate to be a part of an NAACP delegation that was in Geneva, Switzerland, speaking before the Human Rights Council and the United Nations. And it was interesting to hear these representatives, high officials of other countries, representatives talking about the issues here in our country and the fact that not only is it a moral issue, but it's a human rights issue. So it's quite disturbing for me to hear the other side as far as the financial and employment impact with it. I mean, ultimately, as Americans, we should be thinking about sensible laws that make sense and doing what's right. I mean, I understand people are going to lose jobs. There are various industries, the car industry, you know, where people, plants have to shut down, prisons have to close. It's unfortunate. But at the same time, I'm very emotional right now just for the simple fact that I could have still very well still been in prison. I'm grateful for the executive clemencies that Clinton did and what Obama has done, the Fair Sentencing Act. But, I mean, come on. It comes a point where wasting thousands of dollars keeping first-time nonviolent drug offenders in prison for 25, 30, 40, 50 years life, and my situation isn't unique. So it's just, I think that not only, you know, should it change, it has to change. It is way long overdue for that change to happen. So I just pray that the education will continue to happen and, you know, people that will lose jobs, that they'll find another industry to get into from that. But there has to be a change. There has to be this human rights issue. And I'm fortunate that my rights were restored as far as voting rights. But, you know, even coming out of that situation and it taking over 12 years to get my voting rights back, for me to feel equal to another individual going to the polls on election day. That's another reason why I was in Geneva talking about voter suppression laws in the United States. But it's just unfortunate of that fight of redemption. I don't know where that comes into play, but people need to realize that people make mistakes, and there are plenty of people that make mistakes that don't go in prison and don't get caught, but that there deserves to be a right for people to turn their lives around and move forward.
The morals get complicated here. Mark Oster, you were a federal prosecutor, and as you say, this was ramped up as a kind of moral crusade. Now there's a crusade maybe from the other direction saying it went too far to get our national morals back in line. We've got to ramp it down. We've got a listener here, May, who says the drug war also has a deep racial component. War on drugs is war on poor and people of color. You were a federal prosecutor, Mark. What do you make of that assertion?
Well, I can tell you that I was a federal prosecutor in Detroit. I wasn't necessarily a great federal prosecutor, and I was only did it for 5 years. But it was from 95 to 2000. And a lot of, as a new prosecutor, a lot of the cases I did were crack cases. And even though data tells us that just as many people use crack that are white as black, I think that all of my defendants in crack cases were black. So, of course, there's a racial component. In terms of the morality and what you're talking about relative to that, it's important to listen to Kemba when she's talking about how she was released, that it was through the employment of the pardon power. And this is a part of the calculation, too, of how things can be fixed, is that I come at this, as I think you know, Tom, as a Christian. And as a Christian, when I look at the Constitution, I don't see the Constitution as reflecting the Ten Commandments and everything like that. I think it's a secular document. But there is a Christian virtue that is written in as a constitutional virtue as well, and that's mercy through the pardon power. In Federalist 74, Alexander Hamilton talked about it that way, is that it's a mercy that enters into the political system, into the system of justice, so that when things are out of whack, when we've got someone like Kemba, there is a way to right that wrong. And I think that part of the reforms that are being talked about as well is going to have to do with this president, in a pretty brave and unprecedented way, using the pardon power to address some of the prison population that shouldn't be there.
Do you think he's going to go back and that we'll see some significant number of prisoners from the heavy crack cocaine sentencing years released or see their sentences reduced?
I do, Tom. And the Deputy Attorney General, Jim Cole, has made a couple speeches publicly talking about the desire of the administration to do this. And that's incredibly significant. That hasn't happened, a principled use of the pardon power on narcotics sentencing, since John F. Kennedy.
It's been that long. Brian Mann, do you see that coming?
Yeah, I think that there is a push of that magnitude here. I think there's one other thing, Tom, that I want to add to the conversation about the moral dimension of this conversation. One of the things that's really interesting about this shift that began in the 70s to using prisons as a way to deal with the drug epidemic that existed is that it opened the door to using prisons for a lot of other social problems. I mean, if you look behind these huge prison complexes that we have now all over the country, you have people who are drug addicted, you also have people who have severe mental health problems. You have people in detention facilities who are there because of immigration violations. And so all of these different problems, homelessness, poverty, we, instead of developing other societal moral mechanisms to deal with that, what we've done since Nelson Rockefeller and Richard Nixon and Jerry Brown teamed up to build this complex, we've gone more and more back to the well of putting people behind bars. And I think this larger moral dimension of what prisons have become in our society is something that people are unpacking. It's not just people like Kemba who went to prison, you know, for a drug crime. You know, we also have people behind bars who are obviously should be in mental health facilities. We have people behind bars who are there in detention facilities all over the country for immigration violations. And this is new. We didn't used to, as a society, use prisons for this huge, you know, range of problems.
But Brian, what do we do then if we reverse course, if we change our incarceration policy, if we bring it way back down, but we haven't in the meantime built up social mechanisms for homelessness, poverty, immigration problems, and right on to, are we just pouring the problems onto the street with, you know, maybe this sort of silver bullet of bringing down prison populations doesn't have a net under it for the fallout?
Yeah, it's a damn good question. And as we do our reporting, one of the things that we see over and over, because money is driving so much of this reform effort, is we see what looks like sort of reform on the cheap. There are some places where they're trying to do recidivism and job training and mental health and drug treatment, but in many cases not. And so one of the things that I would throw on the table is sort of where does this go? Is that this prison reform movement, I think, has real momentum, real bipartisan support, as long as the crime rates continue to stay low. And so far, that is happening. You know, you heard Cornyn talking about what's happening in Texas. So far in New York, Texas, other places, they're reducing the number of people behind bars, but we haven't seen a dramatic uptick in crime. And as long as that lasts, I think this reform movement continues to gain momentum. But if we do see more street crime surging back into New York and Brooklyn and Houston, I think that there will be a lot of pushback for a lot of these politicians.
I want to look at that dynamic. James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I think that, you know, personally, I think that letting the marijuana become a recreational drug was bad enough. But when you're talking about federal crimes, They're usually pretty bad. Your two examples on the documentary, that was a second offense, only got 20 years. The lady on your show, her boyfriend was dealing in kilos, not grams,
yeah.
Kilos.
Yeah.
So you're talking large amounts, and she got out after 6.5 years. We start turning a blind eye. What's going to happen is you're going to see the court costs go up because repeat offenders will be coming back every 5 or 6 years instead of 20 to 25 years. and then they won't be arrested because it's not going to be worth the time of the police officer on the street to keep doing that over and over and over again. It's like traffic stops. Cops don't like to do it because they have to go to court to testify, and the cops don't want to waste their time if nothing's going to happen. And these are serious crimes. Cocaine is bad. It's not just the person taking it. It's the growers. It's the distributors. It's the people on the street that die on the street. It's the people that are killed over the money and the drugs. So one offense of cocaine goes further than just the needle in the arm.
Hey, listen, James, I hear you on all of that. And of course, you know, we're talking maybe not needle with cocaine, but what about those tough prisons? What about the financial cost of that? And do you see a moral cost on that side of the ledger, James? Oh, we lost James right there. We're looking at prison populations and sentencing reform. Brian Mann, what about the argument right there? If you don't have this big hammer hanging over the whole system, it's going to fall apart. Cocaine's a big deal. We should be tough on it.
You know, this is certainly an argument that many prosecutors make, many police departments make. But I think there are a couple of interesting things here, is that as we've done our research and our reporting, we find more and more people in the law enforcement community, in the criminal justice community, not all, it's not universal, but many of them, including people, you know, back in the 70s who instituted a lot of these mandatory minimums, saying this just hasn't worked. The wrong people are getting the wrong prison sentences. They're winding up behind bars for too long. And I think, you know, you are beginning to see people saying we need a shift. You know, one of the things that's really fascinating is that Eric Holder himself has a long history as a drug warrior, a guy who was very much involved in prosecuting the war on drugs.
Yeah.
We've seen a real evolution with him, you know, during this recent uptick in heroin fatalities that we've had. You know, he stepped forward and he called it an urgent public health crisis. And for the attorney general to say this is a public health crisis, not a, you know, a law enforcement crisis, that signals something profound in the way that our top law enforcement official, you know, sees the solution to this problem.
Kemba Smith, what about our caller there in South Carolina who said this is serious, and if we back off on these big sentences, you'll have law enforcement that doesn't want to bother, and you'll have criminals who will go back to it and get back to it faster. We'll have more crime. What about the I mean, you know, your boyfriend was a pretty big dealer. You know, did know the mentality of that realm. How do you think it affects how criminals or potential criminals think, Kemba, if we pull down mandatory sentences?
I think, again, and it goes back to a judge actually being able to look at an individual's culpability and their actual involvement. The fact that I was a first-time nonviolent drug offender, yes, what my boyfriend did was very serious. Like I said, I talked to young people across the country about the poor choices. But at the same time, my crime was the fact that I allowed myself to be in an unhealthy, toxic relationship. I was not criminally minded. I was not thinking about, ooh, what am I going to get? How much money am I going to be able to take from out of the situation? I was in love, or what I thought was love. Mm-hmm. And that was misplaced. But at the same time, I think that there needs to be an re-education, and you don't actually know who most of the federal offenders are in federal prison. And I'm glad that you did bring the subject up, race, because the majority of the first-time nonviolent offenders in federal prison with these drug laws are Black people of color. And so it disturbs me that there isn't a value of life. Again, a morality type situation where a person can just automatically say, well, you know, people that have federal offenses, you know, are really, you know, bad people and they deserve to be there. I really think the mentality needs to change and people really need to look at who's actually those first time nonviolent drug offenders and what crimes are actually being committed.
Mark Osler, you were the prosecutor. Brian Mann points out that this is all taking place so far in a context where crime rates have been down and they're staying down, even as these first moves have been made by states around the country. Do you think these rates will stay down as this movement goes ahead? What might influence that? And if they begin to tick back up, crime rates, are we going to rush right back to big incarceration?
That's the danger. And I fear we don't really understand what causes crime rates. For example, people think it's relative to the economy. But when we had the recent recession, crime rates were going down. So I agree with the caller that narcotics use in America is a real problem. It's a problem in the cities. It's a problem in the suburbs. It's a problem in rural areas. And that as we back away from mass incarceration, we have to think hard about, okay, what are we doing to tackle that problem? And I just want to go back, speaking of morality and how we approach this. In the 1980s, there were two public health crises that came up at the same time, AIDS and crack. And at first, they were both viewed as a moral scourge, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, with AIDS, we treated it like what it was, which was a disease. We hired people that knew about that, bacteriologists and virologists and epidemiologists, and they turned it into a chronic treatable disease. With crack, we never changed. We always treated it as a moral scourge rather than something where you had to identify the causes and solve the problem. It's a market. It's a business market, and you can't wage war on a market by taking out the soldiers, because the market is still there and will be fulfilled. And that's what's happening. We have to do something to address that market. Something else. Even within the context of law enforcement, we could do something like focus on cash flow and address it that way.
Focus on cash flow. You mean dealers, drug dealer cash flow, or some other?
The cash flow going back to sources between drug dealers. If we take the money out, the business will fail.
People trying to think in new ways, creative ways about crime. Brian Mann, what do you think? The pendulum swung way up on incarceration. Do you think it's going to swing way down, Brian? A little down? How far?
Yeah, it'll be hard to know right now, but I do think that if this becomes a big issue during the presidential campaign, which it could in 2016 with Ted Cruz and Rand Paul both making this an issue, this could go far.
Brian Mann with North Country Public Radio, Mark Osler, Kemba Smith. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Changing Picture on Incarceration. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.